Hello, this is Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore, and you are listening to Catholic Baltimore on Q1370 WQLL. Catholic Baltimore is a weekly radio program hosted by the Archdiocese of Baltimore, airing each Sunday following the broadcast of the Radio Mass of Baltimore. We are grateful to our Catholic radio partners for sharing with us some of the contents in this program and for the opportunity to bring quality Catholic programming to the Archdiocese of Baltimore every Sunday.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We're here with Father Michael Roach. Father Roach, thanks for being with us.
Grand to be here.
What do we know about the fifth Archbishop of Baltimore, Samuel Eccleston?
Very interesting character. He was a convert, born in the Upper Eastern Shore in Kent County, came to St. Mary's in Baltimore, which was also a lay college at that time, for his education, and there found his vocation as well. Joined the Sulpician Fathers and was a member, if you will, the more progressive wing, the more Americanizing wing of the Sulpicians at that time.
And what was his relationship, if any, to Archbishop Whitfield? How did he become the selection, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Right. Remember, of course, there's not exactly a huge cadre of priests at this time, so the priests in Baltimore were very well known to each other, and the Sulpicians were often the advisors and the pariti, if you will, to the Archbishop's office. He'd call upon these men for input and scholarly research.
And what was the position of the Church in the United States at that time in terms of, you know, how it was perceived and what, if any, influence it had in terms of secular issues, and certainly as immigration expanded, what was
Surely.
The church called on to do?
Surely. Things were getting rough for the church in these days. There had been the rise of nativism beginning in 1829 and just getting more ferocious, really, up until the Civil War. We think of the great incidences in Boston and in New York, convent burnings and riots and the like, Philadelphia as well. Baltimore didn't suffer quite so much, probably because Baltimore had a well-established and respected Catholic population. But Eccleston did have those problems to deal with as well.
And he served during his 17-year episcopacy at a time when especially Irish immigrants were coming to this country en masse, and Baltimore was a large port of entry. How did he deal with that?
Right. It's interesting that very often it was the older, more American bishops who were more aware of the problems of the immigrants. It's rather ironic. So he was someone who was interested in establishing parishes where they had Irish priests, parishes where they had German priests, and seeing these people were served in their native language and according to the customs of their particular practice of the faith.
Mm-hmm. When he is at 34, he was relatively young to become an archbishop, especially when he didn't convert to Catholicism until the age of 18. That's a pretty astounding fact, it seems to me.
Absolutely.
That would be a big challenge in terms of how he would approach his position. He presided over several provincial councils in his time as archbishop. Do we know what became of them? The Blessed Virgin Mary was named patroness of the United States during that time. Were
right.
there any other takeaways?
No, it was much more of the disciplinary actions. There was very little doctrinal things that were done. It was always about where the money was to go and what money was to go to the Holy See, what money was to go to the diocese, and particularly for the mission efforts.
Mm-hmm. When you look at how the diocese would have operated then compared to today, obviously it wasn't as large in scope administratively.
Mm-hmm.
How did it support parishes at that time? Was it at all relied upon? You know, how did parishes view its role with the diocese or its relationship?
Right. That's an interesting question. I think they never sought fiscal support from the diocese. They knew that the diocese wasn't that much better off than they were. So there was more independence in the financial matters of the various parishes. The whole question of where you get your money from was an interesting one because in Europe, the churches had either been run by the religious orders that paid for it or they were supported by the government. Here, there had to be a new way of supporting church. And it was voluntarism, that you had that you took up a collection, that you paid pew rent, that you had seat offerings, things that continued really in some places well into the 20th century. So it was a challenge indeed. Now, many of the parishes were still run by religious orders. The Jesuits, the Redemptorists had come, and some other congregations.
Mm. It seems that he was a pretty visionary man in terms of recognizing current and future challenges and taking unique approaches to them. It's reported that he founded, or at least during his time, St. Charles Minor Seminary began under his reign. What do we know about St. Charles?
Well, that was a gift of Charles Carroll of Carrollton, and he, who had been the richest man in colonial America, and he gave land adjacent to his estate in Howard County across the Frederick Pike from his own property, and the first minor seminary in the country was built there, St. Charles College, and stayed there until the early 20th century when it burned down and was moved into Catonsville and Maiden Choice Lane.
Mm-hmm. He was reportedly a gifted preacher. Do we know anything about his style, not either as a preacher or just his leadership style in general?
Right. Because he was a young man, he had a very vital kind of tenure. He was very ill. He was injured in an accident a few years before his death, and he lost a lot of that vitality after that stagecoach accident. But in his early years, he was really a house of fire. And again, he was very interested in the educational apostolate. He saw that many more schools were founded, and he was very hands-on.
The administrative duties of being a metropolitan archbishop, apparently that of naming new bishops were among the things he wasn't crazy about doing. Does that speak to his provincialism? Was he more concerned with, you know, those issues that were in his backyard, or was it just new to him, or maybe mm-hmm. a combination of things?
I don't know that he was interested in the Roman politics that lead to who gets appointed where as a bishop. He was very much the American.
Mm-hmm. In terms of how he viewed his true position and
right.
what his role
right.
was. Tell me more about the accident. What do we know about where that occurred? Do we know where it occurred?
Out on the mission, I think he was either going or coming back from one of the missions.
Right. And the stagecoach was somehow...
Right. Tossed over, and he was injured as the coach went over.
And that would eventually lead to his... Decline
yes.
in health.
It's a decline in health, right.
And ultimately his death.
Right. He wasn't an old man when he died.
No. At 34, he served 17 years, right. Would have been just in his early 50s.
Right. Exactly.
As I mentioned, he's reportedly seen as a visionary, and one of the issues he would have had to deal with was how to minister to a growing black Catholic community.
Right. If he had a blind spot, I'm afraid his blind spot was in the interracial apostolate. The Oblate Sisters of Providence, the original black congregation of sisters, was having a hard time. And when the question was referred to him, he said, cui bono, I mean, to whose good is this? And he suggested that perhaps they disperse and go into the homes of the Catholic gentry as maidservants. Mm. So he wasn't particularly enlightened on the racial question, which may have been a reflection of his Eastern Shore culture.
Certainly. And so with that not being the final word, how should history remember Samuel Eccleston as the fifth Archbishop of Baltimore?
Right. He was a doer. He got a lot done in his early years, especially. And he brought a vitality to the archdiocese. Whitfield was grand, but Whitfield was old. But Eccleston was full of youthful energy.
And up until that point, other than John Carroll, had served the longest in the position.
Right. Exactly.
That's Father Michael Roach speaking about the episcopacy of Samuel Eccleston, 5th Archbishop of Baltimore.
Catholic news from the Archdiocese of Baltimore and around the world from the Catholic Review. There is new state scholarship money, $5 million, available for kindergarten through grade 12 students who wish to attend non-public schools, including Catholic schools, and the Archdiocese of Baltimore wants families to know about it. The BOOST program, which stands for Broadening Options and Opportunities for Students and Teachers, is the result of 10 years of lobbying for school choice by the Maryland Catholic Conference, the legislative lobbying arm of Maryland's bishops, and other groups. One local school, Our Lady of Victory in Baltimore, helped parents of 14 current students and 4 prospective students complete the application in the first few days after the process opened to the public. The program serves students from families with incomes equal to or below 185% of the federal poverty level. For a family of 2, one adult and one child, that is just under $30,000. For a family of 4, it's nearly $45,000. July 11th is the deadline for families to apply for the scholarships available for the 2016-2017 school year. For information and to apply, visit MarylandPublicSchools.org/boost. St. Leo the Great Parish in Baltimore's Little Italy hosted again its annual St. Anthony procession June 5th. A statue of St. Anthony of Padua was the centerpiece of a procession through the streets of Little Italy, which was led by the Baltimore City Department Fire Department's truck number 5 and trailed by mass goers and parishioners. The tradition dates back to 1904, the year of the great Baltimore fire that reshaped the city. The annual street festival gives thanks to St. Anthony for his intercession and includes Italian specialties and a bocce tournament. From the newsroom of the Catholic Review, this is Christopher Gunty.
Do you want to know more about what's going on in the church and the world than you can get from your daily newspaper or local TV? Read the only publication in the Archdiocese of Baltimore that covers the church full-time, the Catholic Review. Pick up the print magazine monthly at your parish or have the Catholic Review delivered to your home every month. You can get fresh news every day online at catholicreview.org. Subscribe to the Catholic Review e-newsletter for twice-a-week updates. Just text CR Media to 84576. Find our app on Apple and Android, and follow the Catholic Review on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Wherever your faith takes you, Catholic Review Media is ready to inspire, teach, inform, and engage. Read it today, in print and online, at CatholicReview.org. That's CatholicReview.org.
Catholic Baltimore takes a look at the men who have led the Premier See of Baltimore since its inception in 1789. With the help of Father Michael Roach, church historian and professor of church history at Mount St. Mary Seminary, we are offered a glimpse into the challenges and achievements, the education and background, and the leadership qualities of those men who have served as Archbishop of Baltimore. This is Sean Kane, and you're listening to Catholic Baltimore. We're here with Father Michael Roach. Father Michael, thanks for being with us.
It's good to be here.
So what do we know about Francis Patrick Kenrick, who would succeed Samuel Eccleston in 1851 after a 17-year episcopacy?
A rather remarkable family, actually. There are two archbishops in that family, Francis Patrick in Baltimore and Peter Richard in St. Louis. They were Dublin-born. Came to this country to serve in the missions. Francis Patrick Kenrick was on the frontier for a while in Kentucky, taught in the seminary there at Bardstown, and eventually is named as Bishop of Philadelphia, and then later as Archbishop of Baltimore. A scholarly man and a great translator of the scriptures, something of a moral theologian. His moral theology was used for many years in Catholic seminaries in this country.
Was he the first Archbishop of Baltimore who previously had served as bishop somewhere else?
He was the first one promoted to Baltimore, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Right. And do we have a sense of how that prior experience might have helped him in his new position?
Well, one thing he would have brought from Philadelphia was a passion for the schools, which was always emblematic of Philadelphia diocese. He also, up in Philadelphia, had made the friendship of John Nepomucene Newman, the Redemptorist bishop, the Redemptorist who becomes a bishop. In fact, I think that Newman was his spiritual director when he was bishop of Philadelphia.
He said, as the son of a scrivener, to have had meticulous handwriting and also was fluent in 4 modern languages and 3 ancient ones. That's quite a background for a bishop.
Yeah, very much the professor, and he had taught in the seminary early on and continued to write all of his days.
What were some of the things that he wrote about? We know he was responsible for an English translation of the New Testament, and then he wrote about the real presence of the Eucharist. Were there other topics that seemed to be of interest to him?
Well, unfortunately, he writes on the question of slavery in a rather benighted fashion, and says that slavery is not immoral, but the taking of slaves is, the holding of slaves is not. And that's a very embarrassing position that sort of marred the church for many years.
And would that have been reflective of in other words, was he an outlier in thinking that way at the time, or was he just voicing what others felt privately?
Interestingly, it probably is indicative of the immigrant's unfortunate desire to be accepted and to be American, to be truly American. So you take on the values of the society you've come to and try to be more American than the Americans.
He presided over the first plenary council, and every 3 years the provincial councils and synods. What do we know? I think the prerogative of place emerged from one of these. What other decrees might have come out of these meetings?
Well, again, finances are always a great concern. Seasons of the church, uniformity in liturgy, just many, many practical things were dealt with. When you read the decretals of these various councils, they go on and on and on. There's almost no end to them.
And what was the picture in the church at this point? This is the 1850s. Civil War is coming upon us. What was the country looking like, both in the Catholic population but also secularly?
Well, this is also the great era of persecution of the church by the nativists and the know-nothings. So it was said that even in Baltimore, when traveling, the sisters wouldn't wear their habits because they were afraid they'd get hassled too much. And you read records of them going hither and yon and having to don secular clothes. There were many, many problems for the church in those days, mainly external, not internal so much.
And give us a quick history lesson on the know-nothings.
The know-nothings, the American Party. Called Know Nothing because whenever they're questioned about, they knew nothing, you know. And they gained a lot of political sway and held some state houses in the country. In one particular election in Maryland, the Know Nothings carried everything except Emmitsburg and Leonardtown. So they were a threat politically, but also practically. Church burnings, rioting, and the like.
It's said we owe our connection to the 40 hours of devotion here in the Archdiocese to Archbishop Kenrick, perhaps something else that came out of Philadelphia.
Sure, through St. John Newman actually was the one who brought the 40 hours of devotion and propagated it in Philadelphia. And then when Bishop Kenrick became Archbishop Kenrick here in Baltimore, he brought that with him. Interestingly enough, it's still pretty highly preserved in Pennsylvania. Many, many parishes in Pennsylvania still keep the 40 hours, which has largely disappeared here except for the ethnic parishes.
And for those who are unfamiliar with it, just briefly explain the 40 hours.
Oh, it's 40 hours of Eucharistic adoration, usually over a weekend marked by devotions and sermons.
Do we have a good understanding of how Archbishop Kenrick handled the outset of the Civil War and maybe how that might have impacted his episcopacy at all?
Right. Sadly, he dies the same week as the Battle of Gettysburg. So Maryland, which was so terribly divided during the Civil War, it find itself even thrown into more chaos by the death of the Archbishop at that time, at that decisive battle. He was not particularly partisan, although I have to say, We need to remember that the Catholic paper at that time was privately owned, and so they didn't take their marching orders from the Archbishop. And so at one point, the Catholic Mirror is so partisanly Confederate that the two editors are arrested and put in jail, as a matter of fact, for sedition.
It's history suggests that he had a rather lengthy competition, shall we say, with Archbishop Hughes from maybe from his days in Philadelphia. What do we know about that?
Hughes was a great man, but he was also a wild man, and he wasn't anyone to be toyed with. And I think there may have been a certain pettiness about Archbishop Kenrick, and he tried to nail John Hughes a few times, which was not something you could pull off too well. John Hughes had a lot of connections in Baltimore, though he was from Ireland and then to Chambersburg, PA, but he had a lot of family and kin here in Baltimore, so he was often here for various events, and Kenrick could be a bit carping about him.
And was Archbishop Hughes serving in, where was he serving at the time? Or would have been serving while Archbishop Kenrick was in Baltimore?
A bishop of New York.
In New York, right. What was Archbishop Kenrick's relationship like with the priests? Do we have an indication of that?
I don't think he was a great favorite. I'm not sure. But Baltimore priests have always been terribly independent. So that's not a surprise.
The diocese certainly grew exponentially in his time, given the influx of immigrants. Would you look at his record and suggest that Francis Patrick Kenrick was up to the challenge?
He certainly was, particularly in the earliest years of his reign. A very bright man, there's no question about it. But how energetic he was, particularly toward the end, I wouldn't be willing to say.
So not the vitality that Samuel Eccleston had, for sure.
No.
Any final words on Francis Patrick Kenrick?
It's a shame that his teaching on interracial relations was so backward, because he really was a fine scholar in other ways, but he did have this blind spot.
That's Father Michael Roach speaking about the episcopacy of Archbishop Francis Patrick Kenrick in the Archdiocese of Baltimore.
You're invited to the National Opening Mass of the Fortnight for Freedom, Tuesday, June 21st at 7 p.m. at the Basilica of the Assumption in downtown Baltimore. This Mass will be celebrated by Archbishop William E. Lurie and begins a 14-day period when Catholics and others can pray, reflect, and act to promote this first most cherished freedom. For more information, visit www.archbalt.org. May God bless you, and may God bless America.
Life can be hard, and at times we feel overwhelmed and alone. When faced with problems, know that there is a group of Catholics who are part of the prayer ministry of the Archdiocese of Baltimore, waiting to lift you and your needs to God in prayer. This ministry is comprised of men and women, young and old, religious and lay, from every ethnic and cultural background. They pray as individuals and in groups, in homes and meeting spaces throughout Baltimore. Like you, they are people who have suffered the same hurts, fears, pains, sickness, loss, and everyday burdens. Learn more about this ministry by visiting our website at www.archbalt.org. If you are in need of prayer, send your prayer request to prayers@archbalt.org or by phone to 410-547-5517. Would you like to volunteer to be a part of the ministry? Prayer ministers are always needed. Please call or email our coordinator, who would be happy to speak with you.
The season of sacraments is nearly here. First Holy Communion, Confirmation, and weddings. Visit the Baltimore Basilica, America's first cathedral, and stop by the gift shop for all of your gift needs. From beautiful frames to crucifixes and crosses, statues and one-of-a-kind rosaries, the Basilica Gift Shop has it all. Friendly, knowledgeable staff members can help you select the perfect gift. Also available, Baltimore's very own Mouth Party Caramels, locally designed hand-painted signs and jewelry, plus gifts for Easter, as well as an extensive line of St. Patrick's Day items, sure to bring out the Irish in everyone. Visit the Basilica Gift Shop at 409 Cathedral Street in Baltimore or call 410-727-3565 for hours and directions. Free street parking available directly in front of the Basilica between 9:30 and 4 p.m.
For over 200 years, the Archdiocese of Baltimore's Catholic schools have welcomed families of all faiths, providing generations of students with an academically excellent, value-based education taught in a Christ-centered environment. With a 99% graduation rate, the highest in the nation, and a 98% college attendance rate, Catholic school graduates are better prepared to succeed in college and beyond. But Catholic schools offer more than an education. They offer tradition, family, faith, and the opportunity for students to grow as individuals and as future leaders in their community. Discover these and other benefits of a Catholic school and learn more about why Catholic schools are an unparalleled value in education in the Baltimore region. Call 1-800-5-CATHOLIC or visit www.archbalt.org. Catholic schools, a place to grow.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of Catholic Baltimore. As we prepare for the week ahead, let us do so in prayer together as one community of faith. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Let us also ask the blessing and intercession of our Blessed Mother as we pray. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. May God bless us and keep us always in his love.